Accession number 20376, Reel 2.
Peter Fisher, Reel 2.
Thank you, thank you. The battalion was reorganising, down to low numbers, and was taking on reinforcements all the time. We were due to go into Germany, Göttingen, in April. So we had to be back to a reasonable number. And this is where my responsibility started. Being company clerk, if you've ever seen MASH, you know, that surgical thing in Korea, and Radar, who ran the place, well, this is a company clerk running the place, well, running the company. Getting everything came to the company clerk. I had to do everything. My sergeant major, for instance, would say, right, I've got to be out training all day long. When I come back, I want all the part one orders, you know, part two orders, company orders, typed up and written out, just to sign, so I can get off, get to the sergeant's mess for a drink and a, you know, shower. If there's anything wrong, you'll hear about it. And then there was never anything wrong. I could organise. It was my first real responsibility. And this went right the way throughout, right until July, till I was in Germany and finally came home for Dimon, running the company. And when I did come home, there's a letter waiting. Before you decide what to do, come and see me. So I went to see my old teacher. And he said, if you're interested, there's a local paint manufacturer, a very old one, founded in 1800. And they need a young chap technical rep, if you're interested. So I was, rang up, got the job, a very responsible job. At the same time, this teacher also got me teaching evening classes at the School of Art, where I've been a student since I was 15. And before long, I was doing three nights there and a night at Chesterfield, teaching responsibilities. And in fact, that's all my life's been ever since. And it's thanks to the army, really, because up to that point, I was responsible for myself, organising myself as a job, or doing sign writing, whatever I was doing during my apprenticeship. But, okay, here, there was responsibility on organising other people.
Why is a company clerk so important in a battalion, in a company?
Well, he's the one that makes out all the guard duties. Puts everybody else on but himself, of course, and the fire pickets and everything like that, but everything that's going to be, all the platoon commanders, for instance, there's three rifle platoons, second lieutenants and their one, what's on tomorrow, sort of thing coming in, and they need to be kept up to date with, so that they're not going to get caught out themselves. And you're in that position where all that information comes from the company clerk, and you just feed it out.
So there's plenty of opportunity for abuse of power.
No, I had none. I was still an ordinary private. I wasn't even given a honorary rank of Lance Corporal to give me a little bit of authority. I didn't have any.
But you were choosing who would go.
Oh no, no, it was strictly on a rota basis. Okay, it wasn't best friends doing this and whatever. You know, the ones you didn't like. Well, it wasn't a matter of disliking anybody. No, it was a matter all on a rota basis, so everything was above board in that respect. Well, there's no power to abuse, really.
Can we go back to Kobe, Curie? Because you were telling me about how you separated from your friend who went into a different company.
From Eric, yes.
Can you pick up the narrative from there, please?
Yeah. Well, we travelled up all together, well, overnight boat round to Pusan. Travelled up overnight, well, in fact, a 36-hour journey, which included overnight, on a rickety old train, wooden seats. And, of course, we had to sleep on it, and we're sleeping on luggage racks, on trying to stretch out on the seats and sometimes in the gangways for sleep at the night time. An interesting thing, incidentally, we did get to Seoul. We marched from the train to Britannia Barracks, and on the big parade ground there, right heart, and we're just mingling around, sort of thing, just waiting to be shown where, you know, the bike rooms were. And one of my other mates, he'd been a bit poorly. I was carrying his rifle in his small pack, besides my own kit. Somebody else was carrying his kit bag. And heard a voice, "Where's that bloke with two bloody rifles?" I felt, next thing, I felt a hand on my shoulder. And I looked round, and this hand was enormous. Belonged to a giant. And when I looked around and up, it was a giant. 6'6", enormous. "Have a drink," he said, and shoved a bottle of beer in my hand. Whether he thought I had two rifles, so I meant real business, I don't know. But that was it. "Have a drink," shoved a bottle of beer in my hand, walked off. Then everybody's saying, "That's Bill Speakman. Bill Speakman, VC." It was quite, you know. And just because my mate was a bit off, so I was carrying his rifle. So I'm really very... I'm not that brave. But from there, we then went up to the Shropshires, Shropshire Light Infantry. And all the gear, all the winter gear that we got with us, string vests and boots, two sizes too big so we can get three pairs of socks on and everything else, that was all taken off us. But the first thing they removed from us was our tin hats. You don't need that. And so we had no tin hats. And then we got posted to individual companies and platoons. And I was fortunate, there was a couple of us went to Platoon A Company, Tomo, Roy Thompson, a Nottingham lad. But Eric, he was over in C Company. We was in rest at that time. That means you're a few miles behind the line, out of trouble. Mind you, we're still sleeping in dugouts, holes in the ground, left from previous, you know, through the move north. And it's quite interesting there, at that point in that rest, we had this cinema, which was only a sort of screen with some shelter around it, lots of forms and sandbags to sit on in rows in front, where they used to show a film most nights. And always they had these records, same half a dozen records, Birds in the Treetop on Mockingbird Hill and Johnny Ray and Shrimp Boats Were Coming. Which was nice, until you'd heard them a few hundred times, you know, night after night, because this went round in a cycle. Once they played the six, they played them again and again and again. And at that time, we was at rest, so it meant we was doing some training. So we'd still go out up country, moving as infantrymen should move, single file, well spaced, someone at a point and the others bringing up, burning down any huts, thatched huts that we came to with phosphorus grenades, so they wouldn't shelter infiltrators, which the North Chinese particularly were very, very good at, infiltrating through the valleys and getting behind the lines. And digging, we was back up on the MGM, near the old Gloucester's position, digging more trenches in case the worst came to the worst and we got pushed back to the MGM line again. But and then, of course, we went up into the line, up to the sharp end, up to the Samichon Valley, which is a valley that ran roughly north to south. Running on the Samichon was running into the, a tributary to the Yimjim River. Of course, the Yimjim, that was the big battles in 1951, where the Gloucesters and the Ulster Rifles and the Northumberland Fusiliers, just as much, got some real stick. But in fact, I always think there's one thing about Englishmen, or British, if you like, the Scots are no different in that respect, is for sheer bloody mindedness, you can't beat a Brit. And when you've got a battalion or a company, a battalion of British infantry, that's determined they're going to stop on that bloody hill and nobody's going to move them from it, they stick. Not like the Yanks, bug out merchants. Once you get overwhelming odds, they will bug out. But not the Brits. They stuck it. They stuck and stuck. And that's the I was doing national service, just I suppose I might have made a noise and been a conscientious objector, but I never thought of it. My oldest brother had been in the rough, he did his bit. My another older brother, he'd done his national service. And as I said before, my father was in 1418. So I was doing my bit, didn't question it. And it's, the thing is, I like to think that all these national servicemen that were out there, when it came to, he was proving, you know, your ancestry, your British metal. That's what it came down to. Another metal, if you like, another word for bloody mindedness, but when you was going to do something, you did it. And we went up into the sharp end. But say, Samichon, running north to south. Right at the top end was, the Samichon was the real bloodthirsty. It was 227 and 355, Gibraltar. Little Gibraltar, as they called it. That was always a bone of contention. Since we took them from the Chinese, it was always a bone of contention to keep face. Chinese keeping face during the, you know, ceasefire talks is important to them. So they were elves that were always taking a caning. And sometimes, in fact, the nice thing is when they first took them, it was a Shropshire Light Infantry that took 227. And they'd held it for a few days, put the Yanks in, they lost it. And they sent the Shropshires back in to get it back again, which they did. And that's how the Brits, at that time, Commonwealth Division, they were really proving themselves. But if I can get back to Eric, he was in C Company. And, or a little bit before, no, not quite Eric yet, but the... We was at a quiet part of the line on the Samichon, near Yongdong, a hill called Yongdong. And by a quiet mark, I don't know, whether they knew that the Shropshires were there so they weren't going to get tangled with them, it's a nice thought, whether we was actually given a quiet spot in the line because we were due to come home after that last period in the line, the battalion due to come home, don't know, but it was fairly quiet. That is, if you can call, well, it was quiet as regards attacks and defence. It was quiet even though you might be shelled most days, incoming shells. You still got patrols to do out into no man's land. And the valley there was quite wide that time of the year, summer, June, July, August. The river's fairly shallow, quite easy to wade across towards Chinese lines. And it's another thing about the British infantry. No man's land is what it says. It doesn't belong to either side. But the thing with the Brits is, the Chinese, in this case the enemy, isn't going to get any use out of it. Patrol it. Patrols out every night, different patrols, doing different things. And so life was mainly putting up with the shelling. Had one or two near misses. It's surprising the number of Dutch shells that do come over. And being covered in earth instead of razor sharp hot shrapnel. Lucky. That's when your number's not up. When your number's not on that one. The danger was, of course, going out on patrol and bumping Chinese patrols. They didn't treat it quite the same, no man's land, as us, where we'd go out every night. They would just go out, no, irregularly. So you could never be sure whether he was going to get bumped or bump into one of the patrols or not. And they used to get hot. It was a real joy to come back to a hole in the ground, which was your dugout. And that was home. Getting home at night was a real early hours of the morning. There's a rather unusual thing also about Korea in the summer. We was up on hill positions. And in the summer, temperature up to 100 every day. And at night time, it would go down into the 40s. The humidity, once the temperature dropped, the humidity was squeezing out, hot and sweaty. It's also the mosquitoes came out. So to save being bitten, you had to douse your face and neck with mosquito repellent that stung like hell on all the hot sweat. But even then, they'd still bite through shirts, jumper, you know, a woolen jumper and a thick woolen shirt. They'd still bite through those. And quite a number of chaps afterwards came down with malaria when we did come home. But it was in the mornings that this mist, and if you're out in the valley, you're buried in this mist, if you're out in the valley on patrol. And in the mornings at stand two, typical infantry, whilst it's still dark, before it gets dawn, you stand to at the ready in case there's an attack coming in, you know, with the dawn. Going back to the 1418 style, that was. But mind you, the Chinese were noted for attacking at night. So we stood to at night as well. But in the dawn, as the sun came up, you'd be on top of a little hill. Well, a hill. And lots of other platoons and companies on their hills. And the same with the enemy on the other side. And all in between was a sea of mist. In fact, it was just like being at sea. And in fact, Korea, the land of the morning calm. This was it, the morning calm in summer. The acoustic is unusual. It's that nothingness, not just silence, but nothingness, acoustic. And being surrounded by this sea. And then the sun just comes up, and gradually it's burning off this mist, and it sinks lower and lower, revealing more and more of the hills, until in a very, very short time, it's all gone, and it's just blazing hot again. That is when it's not monsoon season, and your dugouts are knee-deep in water and mud, and the trenches collapsing. I had my dugout collapse on me, well, not quite on me, one night during a five-day period of monsoon, continual stair rods, you know, all day long, all night long. Royal Fusiliers were due to relieve us, and we were going to pull out and go home. And they was held up because it wasn't safe to cross the Imjin on the bridges, either way, north or south. And so we had to stay longer. But one night, some sound woke me up, lit my candle in the dugout, that's all we had. And saw one side of the dugout by the door opening collapsing. Called out to my mate Wally, he was out on stag. He came up, stuck his head through the hole and said, "What's up?" He said, "The bloody thing's collapsing on us." So we managed to get all our gear out. Luckily, because the next morning it was all just total collapse. Fencing pickets over some logs. Fencing pickets bearing tons and tons of sandbags filled with earth, all sodden. There wouldn't have been a chance, you know, if I hadn't heard that sound and had been under it. But there's so many near misses from shelling and being out on patrol and things like that. But that morning calm, it was something special. Anybody who's been there has this feeling, knows this feeling. But it was one day that my most traumatic thing was not battle or anything like that, but it was the day my best mate Eric got killed. He was EC company. But, you know, this grapevine, how things work. I know that one day, anyway, on the grapevine, news was four chaps being killed in C company. And that not long after, names are coming through. Gordon Smiles. No, Gordon Shields, Jimmy Smiley, and Eric Walker. And Eric was my best mate. In fact, all three of them were of that draft that set out from Bupper Barracks. After about 15 that joined the Shropshires, three of them that morning, not just decimated, I don't know, is there a word for 20%, not 10%? 20% of that little intake, a 10% of the entire draft decimated that morning. I couldn't believe it, and it's surprising in the British Army, in the infantry, how much humanity there is. I asked, could I go round to C Company? I didn't believe it. I want to find out. And I was told, yes, take all your gear, take your rifle, take your weapons, take all your ammunition. Just bandoliers all around, like a Mexican bandit, you know, that you see in some of these films. And strung around with ammunition and grenades. And I walked down the hill and along and up into the C Company positions. And I saw the company second in command. He confirmed it. And I know walking back, the hillsides there at the sharp end were barren. Not a thing grew on them. Everything had been blasted away. Hard as iron in the hot sun. A real wilderness, and I just meandered through it somehow back to my own position, stumbling because of the tears and everything. Because that's something else that the army taught me. I'd never known such raw emotion. When I got back, you have to try and cover up, and you just have to bear it. You just have to soldier on, get on with the job.
Well, what happened to you when you visited the company?
Oh, nothing happened there. It was just confirmed. But it was what happened that night. Stand to in the trenches as it was getting dusk. And once it was dark, right, back to the dugout. A night's sleep. My mate was out on stag straight after stand two. He was on the next 2 hours. So I cry and eventually stivel myself to sleep, wrapped up in a blanket, you know, fully clothed, all the lot on. Everything's ready just to pick up at the moment, any moment of alarm. And so I cried and snivelled myself to sleep. And then, it's not right to say, I didn't awake, but I was suddenly aware. And I couldn't move. I couldn't move fingers, arms, anything, legs, nothing would move. And in fact, the next moment, I was up and above and looking down at my own dead body. I've learned since to call what was happening an out-of-body experience. There I was looking down at my own dead body in this dugout on this bench of earth. And then I'm travelling in an immense place. Lots of grey shapes and forms around me, in lines, in rows. Such a vast place. You know there's a roof there, you know there's sides there, but you can't see it, it's there. But all these rows of things in perspective leading into the distance, the brightest of lights you can imagine. And as I was getting nearer to that light, I realised that Eric would be there. But Eric was dead. And if I got there, I'd be dead as well. I didn't want to die. And I fought against it. And next thing I know, I was lying on this bunk in my dugout, this bunk of earth. Awake, I could move my arms and legs, and I snatched the Hessian aside, the sackcloth out from the doorway opening, let a bit of night light in. I was absolutely ready, terrified. And who can you tell? Nobody. It's an experience I've never, you know, it's out of this world experience. And it was just, if I told anybody, they'd think I was around the bend, a nutcase. So you just try and cover it up. But there is compassion in this, for a second time, that same day, or within a few hours of that same day. because even though I was due to go out on patrol, I was sent back to Bietchelon for 24 hours all in all. The nice thing back at Bietchelon, you slept in a bed with a mattress, sheets. You could sleep with nothing on. In fact, from that day, well, back into Civvy Street, I don't wear pyjamas or nothing. I take extreme pleasure in sleeping naked between sheets, just like that night there. A mosquito around, mosquito net around to keep mosquitoes away. It was absolute heaven. But it was to get me away. The sergeant, platoon sergeant and platoon officer sent me away. They'd obviously noticed there's something amiss. But after that, another raw emotion took over. Revenge. Get out there and kill someone. Kill as many as you can. Didn't matter. Didn't matter who. If it was women and children in the way, I don't think it would have mattered. But you lose all fear then. Because that's another emotion I found in Korea, was that cold, clammy sweat of fear when you hear the guns shooting in your direction and you hear them winging about and overhead and to the side of you. That cold, clammy sweat of fear is something awful. And a complete innocent. That was me at the age of 20 or 22 then, by the time I was in the line. Complete innocent. So was Eric. He could have got off. His wife was expecting when we went out on the troop ship from England. And he stayed with his mates, went out with his mates, and he never cradled his newborn son. When I came home, I never visited them either. I didn't know. I thought I'd be blamed. I've come home sort of thing, and now I'm standing on their doorstep. So I never went. And years afterwards, especially about 45 years after, I ignored army, everything army. I couldn't go anywhere near Remembrance Sunday. To hear the last post was absolutely shattering. Until around about 95, I realised that I got to face this. It had been brought to mind by some. In 1987, the Queen uncovered a memorial to the Korean War dead in the crypt of St. Paul's, March 1987. A bit later that year, I was being retired off early from the college, but the main thing is, in July, I'd booked tickets to go to a concert in St. Paul's Cathedral, Berlioz Requiem. Fantastic thing. The chorus, the orchestra, and in St. Paul's. I was going there with my wife and the son, and it must have been bells ringing in my mind. And I tried to dredge up from my mind the date that Eric was killed, and I couldn't. It had gone. I'd thrown it away. I knew it was summer. I knew it was June, July or August. One of those months. That's all I knew. And I did look at one or two old photographs. The old camera's never well focused. I could make out a date on a cross in the cemetery in Pusan. It was July. The year was 52. That was for sure. And the day, it just had to be the 16th when I was going to St. Paul's for this requiem. Hence why would the bells be ringing, stirring up things in my mind? And so I accepted that for some time until, and it was then, no, it wasn't then, it was much later, but 1995, that I began to realise that I must go to a remembrance. And I remember,